When you think about the universe, you think about stars, the planets, and of course the dark stuff, right? But my next guest, I'm willing to bet when he thinks about the universe, he thinks of it as one big giant computer, a quantum computer. Perhaps that's because he's also a researcher in quantum computing and believes if we can just get a handle on how all these calculations are used and made by the universe, how to coax the molecules and atoms and photons of our universe, how the universe did that to help us make everything that we have now, we'll understand much more about computers and maybe even be able to build a giant quantum computer someday for ourselves. So for the rest of the hour, we're going to be talking about the quantum world. Pretty spooky stuff. You know, we talk about it quite often. So you might want to pull over to the side of the road if you're driving because it's the kind of stuff that could make you dizzy. We don't want that to happen here on a Friday afternoon while you're on a crowded highway. So stay with us. Our number is 1-800-989-8255 if you'd like to join in the conversation there with your cell phone on the side of the road. Seth Lloyd is professor in the Department of Mechanical Engineering at MIT. He is author of the book Programming the Universe, A Quantum Computer Scientist Takes on the Cosmos. Just out. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Lloyd.
Thanks, Ira. It's great to be back.
Well, welcome back. Yes. Tell us why. We don't think of the universe as a quantum computer. Why is it a quantum computer?
I need to correct you there. I'm really a professor of quantum mechanical engineering at MIT, or maybe even you might call me a quantum mechanic. You know, your quanta are broke, we fix them.
Broke?
Well, yeah, it's hard to split a photon in two, but you can do it. But it's even harder to put it back together. That's why our rates are so high. My colleagues and I at MIT and elsewhere have been building these quantum computers for a while now, for almost a decade, coaxing individual atoms and photons to store bits and to compute. And in doing that, I realized that essentially not only the atoms that we're trying to build quantum computers out of, but every single atom out there and every photon, every electron, every elementary particle carries with it bits of information. And whenever they collide or bonk off of each other, those bits flip. So the universe is actually already computing, and that's why we can build quantum computers. We're actually hacking into the ongoing computation that the universe is performing.
And what is the computation it's doing?
Well, so in fact, you know, it's been known for a long time, since the latter part of the 19th century, 140, 150 years ago, that every atom registers bits of information. This was a discovery made by the great statistical mechanicians James Clerk Maxwell in Cambridge and Edinburgh, Ludwig Boltzmann in Vienna, and Josiah Willard Gibbs at Yale. They came up with the formulas to describe this funky quantity called entropy, which till then had been known as merely something that stuck up the wheels of steam engines and caused them to do less work than you might want them to do. They realized that entropy had to do with the microscopic motions of atoms and molecules, and phrased in modern terms, the formulas they came up to describe it meant that entropy was the number of bits of information required to describe the motions of these atoms and molecules. And then Boltzmann went and constructed his equation, called Boltzmann's equation, which is actually describes how those bits flip when molecules and atoms collide. So the universe is computing, storing information in the microscopic motions of everything, the vibrations of the air, the vibrations of radio waves. And every time those vibrations change or those bits flip, the universe is computing.
Can we learn anything from this to bring back to our laboratories to make our own quantum computers?
Absolutely. In fact, in order to understand the way in which the universe computes, we actually have to build quantum computers. We have the quantum computers we build. For example, Dave Corey in his laboratory at the Nuclear Engineering Department at MIT builds these beautiful quantum computers made out of 10 or 13 atoms strung together in a molecule. And if you talk to them very nicely and ask them very politely, essentially by shining radio waves on them, you can get those bits to flip and to perform computations. But you can't make them compute unless you understand very well how nature is computing already.
Mm-hmm. Tell us what's the difference between my PC and a quantum computer, how it computes, and why you'd like to build one, and how much how much better it would work.
Well, quantum computers don't run Windows yet. And in fact, they run something more like Linux, I'd say. Or, well, a very basic version of Linux.
I'll put it on my Mac then.
Okay, good. Yes, we want to spread the wealth around here. So the way that your PC works is it busts up the information you type in or speak in or put in with your joystick when you're playing Doom. It busts it up into the smallest possible components called bits. And a bit is a distinction between a 0 or 1, or in a computer, a switch that's open or closed, or yes or no, on or off, heads or tails. It's the smallest possible chunk of information. And in a conventional computer, like yours, a bit can be stored by, say, pouring a bunch of electrons into a bucket for electrons called a capacitor. So you call that, say, 1, a whole bunch of electrons on the capacitor. And then when you empty the capacitor, pour the electrons off, you flip the bit, and we call that a 0, bucket empty. So your computer works by moving electrons around. Now, a quantum computer can work by moving electrons around too. So imagine I have a bit which is a single electron. So single electron over here on the capacitor, that's called a 1, and a single electron over there off the capacitor, we'll call that a 0. That, so far, that's not so strange. It's just taking the ordinary notion of how a bit's stored in an electronic computer and miniaturizing it down to the level of a single electron. But the funky thing happens next, because quantum mechanics is weird. That's a technical term. It means it means weird. It means very funky. If quantum mechanics were a singer, it would be James Brown. Quantum mechanics is the James Brown of sciences, let's say. It's very counterintuitive and strange. And one of the central counterintuitive features is that an electron can be both here and there at the same time. So if the electron is over here and that's 1, and the electron over there is 0, then electron here and there at the same time, in some funky quantum mechanical sense, that's a bit that registers 0 and 1 at the same time, a so-called quantum bit or qubit.
Now, how do you make use of that if you don't know which one it is? I mean, don't we have to know 1 or zeros to store things in the conventional sense?
If only life were so certain, Ira, that would be great. In fact, you know, sometimes not knowing what's going on is helpful. I certainly find that in my own research. And quantum computers use that in a very simple but nice way, but still counterintuitive, to do things classical computers can't. And a good way to think of this is to imagine, what does a bit mean? So a bit on its own doesn't mean anything, 0 or 1, yes or no. It depends on what it does. So for instance, a bit in a computer, say 1 could tell the computer add 2 plus 2, or 0 could tell the computer to add 3 plus 1. A bit is an instruction in a computer. And if you take a quantum computer and you feed in this funky quantum bit, this qubit that reads 0 and 1 at the same time, then it instructs the quantum computer to do this and to do that at the same time. Say to add 2 plus 2 and to add 3 plus 1 at the same time. That's something no classical computer could ever do.
Okay, but can you actually make it do that for you if you're not sure what, you know, what the states of these things are?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, with colleagues at MIT like Dave Corey and Ike Chuang, and at Caltech, Jeff Kimball, a group at NEC in Tsukuba in Japan, we've actually built very simple quantum computers and performed computations where the computer is doing this and that at the same time. In fact, it's doing this, that, and the other thing too.
Is that what gives it its power, the ability to do all these things at the same time?
Absolutely. This kind of quantum multitasking, which, let me tell you, when I became an assistant professor at MIT, my wife was a professor at BU and we had 2 kids at the same time, I learned a lot about the virtues of multitasking. Quantum multitasking is very powerful because the ability to do many things at once allows the quantum computer to explore many, many, many more possibilities than any classical computer could.
And so when might we have a quantum computer on your desktop or instead of my Mac or PC?
Well, if you are willing to reinforce your desktop, we could put one on it right now. if you look at these, you pick up one of these. Well, it's hard to pick up one of these nuclear magnetic resonance spectroscopers, these quantum computers that we have over at MIT. They look like a giant beer keg cooled with liquid helium to cool the superconducting magnets in them. And snaking out of them are wires that connect it to about $1 million of electronics. But in fact, because there are many different ways of building quantum computers, and because they're getting more powerful all the time, and the technologies for miniaturizing the components, just like the technologies for miniaturizing the components of regular computers, are advancing, well, you might be able to get one on your desktop in a decade or two, as long as you don't mind doing many things at once rather than one thing.
Well, yeah, we're all multitaskers. You say in your book that quantum computers then represent the ultimate level of miniaturization.
That's right. A few years ago, I started to investigate the question. Going around and playing around with these quantum bits and building quantum computers, you might as well ask how far could you go? Like, for instance, with the famous Moore's Law, in which the components of electronic computers get smaller by a factor of 2 every year and a half or so. How far can that go? How miniaturized could bits become? And I found that quantum computers actually are storing and processing information at the ultimate limits allowed by quantum mechanics. It takes energy to flip a bit, and the more energy you have, the faster it flips. And the quantum computers that we build right now are flipping bits as fast as they can, given the energy in the microwaves and lasers we zap them with.
1-800-989-8255. Let's go to the phones. Kevin in San Antonio. Hi, Kevin.
Hello.
Hi there.
I had a question about the whole concept of quantum computing for intractable problems that are common in computer science. One example is the difficulty in handling or calculating cryptography or encrypted messages, which is the basis of a lot of national security and stuff like that nowadays, is the intractability problem of being able to solve or calculate, encrypted things and messages or whatever. And nowadays, a lot of the writing has been talking about using quantum computing would be able to solve intractable problems in a tractable time. And it just seems like the whole thing is going to put, if this does come out, it's going to put the whole world on its ear. I mean, it's just such a huge thing to be able to solve intractable problems in tractable time. And it's not just that. There's a lot of classic problems that are...
Right, let me get an answer. First, let me remind everybody that this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow with Seth Lloyd, author of Programming the Universe, a quantum computer scientist takes on the cosmos. Small task. Seth, what do you think? Could we use quantum computers for, breaking these codes?
Well, Kevin, you're exactly right that code breaking is the killer app of quantum computation. With a relatively small quantum computer with a few tens of thousands or hundred thousands of qubits, able to form a few billion operations or ops, which is, peanuts for an ordinary computer, you would be able to break all the public key codes that are used, for instance, to send information securely over the Internet. And it's not surprising that the NSA and the CIA and other three-letter agencies are very interested in quantum computers. Luckily, before you decide that you're not going to buy your coffee over the Internet anymore, quantum mechanics actually supplies a solution to this problem, because if you store bits of information on individual quanta, you can actually distribute information in a way which is provably secure, or at least it's guaranteed by the laws of physics themselves. So in order to break these codes, you'd have to mess around or discover new laws of physics. This technique is called quantum cryptography. So quantum computers not only create problems, at least for the NSA, though I like to think of breaking codes as solving problems. They also provide technological solutions that will allow us the world to continue. And in fact, quantum cryptographic systems are available today. If you are willing to write a big enough check, you can buy one for your house and feel very secure indeed.
What other problems could quantum computing solve that are not solvable today?
So quantum computers are known to be able to search faster than classical computers. So, for instance, you could do database search. I've been fooling around with quantum versions of Google, which we would call Krugle or something like that. But one of the most powerful applications, which is not too far away, we could have these types of quantum computers in a few years. And indeed, we already have some quantum computers out there doing this particular application that are many, many times more powerful than any classical supercomputer is now or could ever be, is to understand how the universe works at its basic and most fundamental scales, to understand what happened in the first few instants of the Big Bang, to understand what happens when black holes evaporate, to understand what happens when you have complex quantum system constructed of gajillions, that's another technical term, of atoms or of elementary particles. With Dave Corey at MIT, we've constructed these quantum simulators, or even you might call them quantum analog computers, because they're analogs of other physical systems we want to simulate. And we're able to simulate all sorts of weird quantum effects that you could never capture on a classical computer. And this is the application that I personally think is going to be the first one. And I think this is very useful, and it's not likely to strike fear into the heart of the NSA.
So you're saying basically if you think the universe is a quantum computer, you've just recreated a model of the universe.
That's right. So, quantum computers are a little chunk of the universe, right? A pretty small one now. The ones are a few atoms across. But at the same time, just as the way that the universe can allows us to construct quantum computers allow us to simulate or reproduce little pieces of the universe.
Mm-hmm. All right. Hold that thought, because hang on, Seth, because we have to take a break and give people some time to get undizzy from this discussion, which I'm enjoying. I hope you are too. Talking with Seth Lloyd, author of Programming the Universe, a quantum computer scientist takes on the cosmos, taking on Science Friday this hour. Stay with us. We'll be back with more of your questions and comments and talking to Seth Lloyd. We'll be right back. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about quantum computing, quantum information, with my guest, Seth Lloyd, professor in the Department of Quantum Mechanical Engineering at MIT in Cambridge, author of the book Programming the Universe, a Quantum Computer Scientist Takes on the Cosmos. And even though it sounds like a big title, and it's a really easily readable book, and it's a very, very interesting and very thought-provoking to read. And when I rudely interrupted Seth, he was telling us about why quantum computing, a quantum computer, is sort of like a bit of the universe, since the universe is a quantum computer.
That's right. It's kind of paradoxical sounding, isn't it, Ira?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know,
That's the quantum world, isn't it?
Yeah, that's a quantum world. And it's a computing world, too. You know, one of the great features of computers is that they can simulate each other. And this is very familiar. You can get a version of Word that runs on a PC, and you can get a version of Word that runs on the Mac. Any program that runs on one computer can be translated to run on another computer. So computers can effectively simulate each other's actions. Mm-hmm. And when I say the universe is a giant quantum computer, on the one hand, I'm speaking completely literally because, as I mentioned earlier, it's been known for really almost a century and a half that every little tiny piece of the universe is storing bits of information. And every time two pieces or elementary particles collide, those bits flip. So the fact that the universe computes has actually been known for a long time. But the fact that it can be used to, say, build a universal quantum computer, or the fact that it itself is a universal computer, is something that people have only begun thinking about over the last few decades. And it has some remarkable and interesting consequences.
Oh, give me one of them.
I was waiting for you to ask me that, Ira.
I'm playing straight man this hour. You're doing very well. Go ahead. I thought you were just going to go ahead and you're on a roll there. So,
Ira, every other time I've been on this show, you peppered me with these great questions and told all these great jokes. So I was worried. I was hoping I wouldn't have to tell any. One consequence is that, you know, quantum computers allow us to understand the weird and funky nature of quantum mechanics. They are essentially little laboratories that allow us to create quantum weirdness and explore its features. We're looking into the possibilities of, for instance, teleporting a rubidium atom from one place to another using a strange quantum phenomenon called entanglement. So that's a nice feature of quantum computers. They're a laboratory for exploring quantum weirdness in the universe.
That's one that's one of my favorite subjects is entanglement.
I know you like quantum weirdness.
It's so spooky, action at a distance. You know, it's so hard to believe that, you know, you entangle two particles and they never separated. You can separate them any distance. You know, we talked about people actually carrying them across rivers now, but they could be on the other side of the universe and something instantaneous happens to them. They influence each other instantaneously, right?
Well, I have to share with you a discovery I made since we last talked about quantum weirdness, this apparent spooky action at a distance that Einstein called it. So I recently, together with some other researchers, found that you could use this spooky action at a distance, this funny quantum entanglement, to escape from black holes, assuming you happen to find yourself caught in one.
I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah, so in fact, if you have this funky entanglement between the inside and outside of a black hole, which you do because Stephen Hawking showed decades ago that black holes radiate, and in fact this radiation that comes out of a black hole is entangled with what's going on inside the black hole. Under the right conditions, something that falls into the black hole, a spaceship or my TV set or indeed I've had several computers that ended their lives as black holes, what falls into the black hole might in fact be able to escape in a transformed form. You might even be able to use a black hole itself as a computer if you could figure out the right way to program it.
Yeah, but can the geeks fix it, Disney?
Yeah, and also let me say that as this theory has not been tried out in practice, I feel obliged to warn the radio audience not to try this at home yet. Do not jump into a black hole just now. We can't guarantee the results.
But that's an interesting point. That's interesting, you know, that the entanglement will survive, you're saying, from one particle in the black hole and one particle out.
Yeah, black holes are intimately connected with entanglement. And in fact, this process of escape from a black hole, if it does work, works by a process akin to quantum teleportation, as on Star Trek, where, this is something that could easily happen on Star Trek. Kirk is teleported, falls into a black hole, and teleports out at the last moment before he hits the singularity.
Wow. 1-800-989-8255. I want to ask you about monkeys at a typewriter, but first let me take a call from a listener, Rhonda in Columbus. Hi, Rhonda.
Hi.
Are we hurting your hair this hour?
What?
Are we hurting your hair this hour?
Yeah, I think so. Well, here's the deal. First of all, this all makes me think about Asimov talking about, you know, sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. This is all just way cool magic. I'm a poet. My deal is I want to know what the new questions are. I don't think we're going to be using quantum mechanics or quantum computers, you know, to do our checkbooks.
Right.
What are the new questions that these things are going to be able to address? How are we going to be different people thinking about different things because of this?
Glad to have a poet with that perspective.
Yeah.
Seth, you up to the challenge?
Well, I don't know what. So I actually regard quantum computers as being kind of poetic. You know, after you've talked with atoms for a while and get on their wavelength and learn to listen to what they're saying back, well, what they're saying has a certain strange and unearthly poetry of its own. And indeed, you might imagine trying to use a quantum computer to compose a poem that says many things at once, except, in fact, poetry often does that. One of the beautiful things about poetry, of course,
exactly,
is that
that's
words
right.
have many meanings. And so maybe we could say that poetry is already kind of quantum mechanical.
And it certainly has spooky action at a distance.
Oh, absolutely.
But I just hope we don't end up being the same old people with this great new thing that we can do.
Yeah, how would we look at ourselves differently? That's a good question. If we do ever, you know, get to the point where quantum computers are common, what kind of different view of the universe would we have, and how would it affect our daily lives? Can you speculate on that, Seth?
Yeah, that's a good question. You mean apart from being able to get on eBay and buy used ski boots and things like that using public key cryptography?
Well, we don't want to ever do away with that.
Yeah, you know, that is a good question. And every time human beings have made a new kind of technology or machine, it has always ended up transforming human beings in ways that were unexpected and very hard to predict. As a scientist and a quantum mechanic, for me, one of the most remarkable machines was the clock. When clocks were first invented, they had a huge effect on how the people saw the world, and they began to see the world as if it were clockwork. And although that sounds kind of silly now, the world is clockwork, this mechanistic view of the universe, the idea that it's a machine, was extremely powerful. And indeed, you can think of it as a basis for all science, particularly looking at biology right now, which is uncovering the mechanistic mysteries of cells. So I actually think that in learning to view the universe not just as a machine, but as an information processing machine, and specifically as a quantum information processing machine, we're likely to see the world very differently and come to new understandings of it. And I don't know what those understandings are going to be. And you as a poet maybe are the person to tell us those. For me, those understandings come for a better understanding for, you know, how to build quantum computers and how to make them compute. And then maybe also we can understand things about how life began or how the universe became so complex by looking at quantum computation. But, you know, predicting the future, the technological future, is a mug's game, so I better stop there.
Thanks.
What do you say? What do you say, Rhonda? You happy with that answer?
We'll see how it plays out. I'll write a poem, see what comes up.
Send it to us.
Okay.
We'll put it on a website.
All right.
Thanks a lot, Rhonda. 1-800-989-8255. I want to get to a part in your book which really exposed a fallacy that we've been hearing about for many, many years, and that's the idea that if you put a monkey in front of a typewriter and give it enough time, it could type, you know, randomly typing at the keys, could type out all of Shakespeare. You say that's impossible.
Well, not
But you
impossible.
Say that with a quantum computer, you can get there a little faster.
Absolutely. Not impossible, Ira, but just really unlikely. So that image of monkeys typing into a typewriter, it took me a while to track that down. But it was originated in the first decade of the 20th century, the great French mathematician Emile Borel, who was a probabilist and a combinatorist, created the image of a million monkeys typing 10 characters a second. And he pointed out that these monkeys, which he, of course, he wrote this in French, so he called them singes dactylographiques, which somehow sounds better.
Of course.
These monkeys...
May we?
These monkeys had a chance, albeit an extremely small one, of typing out all the books in all the libraries in the world. Of course, he then went on to point out that their chances of doing this were infinitesimally small and so small as to be effectively impossible. And indeed, in my book, I Programming the Universe, I calculated just how much of Hamlet monkeys could have typed if every elementary particle in the universe was a monkey and they'd all been typing at the maximum possible rate allowed by the laws of physics since the universe began. And the answer I got was something, say if they're trying to type Hamlet's soliloquy, was something like, to be or not to be, that is the...
That's all they could type. Every monkey, if every particle, every atom was a monkey typing on a typewriter, that's as far as they'd get.
It's just extremely unlikely to type Hamlet on a typewriter if you're a monkey.
And if you were... if you were using a word processor, could
well,
you get any further?
No, because then the word processor would be constantly interrupting you to tell you that you would miscapitalize and misspell things, so you'd never get anywhere. but there is a way you could get there, and in
the
fact,
blue screen of death.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, there is a way you could get there, and I would say this is probably the way that we did get here. If the monkeys are typing not into a word processor or a typewriter, but into a computer, if they're programming the computer, say, in Java with random programs. So just typing random bits, which the computer then interprets as instructions to do something. Remember, bits for a computer mean do this or do that. And then the next bit says do this other thing. So if these bits are interpreted rather than just let sit there, then you can prove mathematically that the computer has a very good chance of producing essentially any kind of mathematical pattern that you like, say the laws of physics and chemistry, or the computer with a very short program that the monkeys could type in by chance could start proving all possible mathematical theorems or driving all possible mathematical structures. Anything that could be described using numbers or words could be produced by this computer, and indeed would be likely to be produced by this computer. So you could say that if monkeys typing into a typewriter produce almost nothing, you could also say that monkeys typing at a computer could produce everything.
Wow. Talking with Seth Lloyd, author of Programming the Universe, a quantum computer scientist, takes on the cosmos on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow. Is this connected to quantum computing or just with a normal computer that we have?
Well, of course, you can have monkeys type on a normal computer, and indeed a group in Nottingham did just that in the Nottingham Zoo. They gave the monkeys computers, and which luckily they covered with plastic sheets, because after the monkeys had defecated and urinated on the computers a number of times, they finally figured out they could type stuff, and as the researchers said, they exhibited a fondness for the letter S. However, if the computer is a quantum computer, then you have this feature that I described earlier, that if the bits going into this computer are quantum bits, then the computer, the quantum computer, is guaranteed to do this and that at the same time. And a quantum computer that's programmed with lots of quantum bits, and you can think of these quantum bits as being like monkeys, it will start producing all possible mathematical structures in this quantum parallel way, in the way I just described. And so I claim in the book, and I think that this is a scientifically verifiable claim, that if you take a computer, and indeed we have a computer because the universe is computing, and it's a quantum computer, and if you take a bunch of monkeys, and here the monkeys are these little tiny quantum fluctuations that tell the universe to do this or that, that say, let's form a galaxy here, or that say, oh, let's split this piece of DNA here over in this other place, that these little accidents program the universe. And it's this process of programming the universe with quantum fluctuations that gives rise to the computation we see around us, which produces all sorts of complexity and structure and beautiful things and horrible things and most of all, amazing things.
Very, very eloquent. That's almost poetic there.
Well, I did have practice writing the book, Ira.
That's a good image, and it explains a lot. And in about a minute that I have left, can you give us, Seth, a roadmap of where quantum computing might go in the next 5, 10, 20, 30 years?
Oh, absolutely, Ira. So I think that giant quantum computers that are going to break these codes and strike fear in the hearts of the NSA are a decade or two away at the earliest. Again, it's very hard to predict technological progress. Indeed, I think that it's far too early, for instance, to start some kind of mini Manhattan project to build these. I think we'd be better off sharing openly our scientific advances with other scientists around the world to build them. These quantum simulators that can simulate chunks of the universe and that can construct a new understanding of how complex quantum systems can behave, we can build simple versions of those already, ones with a few billion atoms, and investigate the properties of matter. And I think that for simulating more stranger things and for investigating quantum weirdness, I think we're just going to have a string of ever more powerful quantum computers. And indeed, looking out there right now, since the last time we talked a few years ago, the number of quantum computers in the world has gone up by a factor of 100 or so. People are computing with atoms, molecules, superconducting circuits, quantum dots, electrons, etc. Basically, anything out there that you can shine light on in the right way, you can make it compute. So it's a pretty exciting time for quantum computing, Ara.
That's a great way to end, Seth. Thank you very much for taking time to talk with us. You've given us a lot
to
think
about. Oh, and
thank
you very much for having me back. It's been fun chatting.
You're welcome. Seth Lloyd, author of Programming the Universe, a quantum computer scientist, takes on the cosmos. Great book. I highly recommend it. Kimberly Jones is our technical director. Our audio engineers are Neil Rausch in New York and Linda Mack in Washington. And we had help today from Alan Matz at WGBH in Boston. Greg Smith composed our theme music, and also NPR librarians Kim Molesky and Alphonse Finn certainly chipped in to give us some help this week. Surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. You can leave us email there. Science Friday's Kids Connection is up there. Also, we're blogging and podcasting on sciencefriday.com and welcome your participation. Also, Science Friday's Kids Connection is there, and you can download free teaching materials based on Science Friday. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.